Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and I hope all our listeners in the United States had a nice Thanksgiving. Big holiday week, pretty slow news week actually, and we will be chatting with Adam Boileau in just a moment about all the week's security news. And then we're going to hear from this week's sponsor guest, Ryan Callenber from Proofpoint. And that one's a great interview. Ryan basically says that the entire InfoSec industry pushing into building more detection and response products might not really be that sensible, considering most organizations don't actually have detection and response teams. And some of the VC raises we've seen lately are kind of nuts, and they're going into those elite product categories for big enterprise. We saw a $1.3 billion Series D go to Lacework, and that seems high. Let's just say that. So Ryan will pop along a little bit later on to talk about how the industry only investing in products for the security 1% is kind of nuts. And as I say, yeah, that's a great interview. That is coming up later. But first up, it's time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And I guess, as I mentioned at the intro there, Adam, it is kind of a slow news week, which is nice. We get to have a bit of a breather and maybe go a little bit more in depth on some stories. The first story, though, to talk about this week is Israel restricting the number of countries it will allow its offensive cyber companies to export to down to 37 countries from 102. So this is a very big shift. I mean, this is going to not be received well by companies like NSO Group, I would imagine, because they just had their market cut out from under them.
Yes, this is a pretty big change. And, obviously Israel has seen a bunch of pressure from the outside, over the last 6 months to a year, on NSO Group and some of their other vendors. And yeah, we talked a couple of weeks ago about some of the tie-ups between political figures and in Israel and this kind of whole industry. And, I didn't really understand the tie-in with diplomacy in the region. Interesting to now see this change come out. And of course, the list of countries that they are now willing to sell to without an otherwise special license, is mostly Western democratic countries, Australia, Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, through Canada, UK, US, the sorts of countries that you probably expect.
Yeah.
And that's, as you said, that's going to be a big change for NSO. NSO is having a bad time, full stop. We've seen a bunch of reports about, their financial situation being a bit precarious, both from the negative publicity, having to throw a few of their customers under the bus when they've been doing shonky things. And then this obviously is going to have a big impact on them. As you say, their market is now a fraction of what it was.
Yeah. So interesting story, that one. And it's not really clear why. And I think that's quite curious, right? Because it's sort of the best we can figure, like just the people between me and the people that I've been talking to about this, the best we can figure is that there's been some diplomatic pressure exerted on Israel, probably from the United States.
Yeah, I think that seems pretty likely. I mean, the position that they were getting put in, that Israel was being put in by the amount of publicity and the amount of, just kind of abuses coming to light and things that really are pretty hard for them to defend. Plus, obviously it's a bad look to have these kinds of tools available. Limiting proliferation, is a thing that the US has been concerned about in other fields, and, seeing them apply similar sorts of logic to the cybers, I guess, is not unreasonable. And, the kind of pressure that they would apply, this is probably what we would expect to see as a result of that.
Yeah, you wonder what the carrots were and the sticks were, though, get Israel to do this, right? Because I can't imagine it's a small ask to get them to do this in such a big sort of booming industry over there. But anyway, look, it's interesting. So I've linked through to Catalin Kimpanu's write-up of that one over at The Record. Another one from Catalin here. The United States has sanctioned 28 quantum computing entities across China, Russia, Pakistan, and Japan, also including a company in Singapore. So this is kind of interesting. This is about the United States trying to restrict the flow of quantum computing technology to countries that it wouldn't necessarily describe as, BFFs.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't really understand what the full impact of quantum tech is going to be. Obviously, there's a lot of, kind of speculation about how it's going to impact cryptography and kind of how we have to get ahead of it. And there's been lots of work, in the government sectors to address, you know, quantum resistant cryptography and you know, how this is going to look in a few years. And yeah, interesting to see kind of sanctions focused specifically on organizations doing that, although there's also some of the companies that are being sanctioned are also involved with selling stuff onwards to North Korea, for example, procuring technology for North Korea and China. So, you know, regardless of what particular tech that was, I could see that being a, you know, a target without the quantum aspect. But yes, and also a bunch of stuff related to the nuclear industry in Pakistan, you know, whether they need quantum things or whether they just need centrifuges, I'm not quite sure. But yeah, I mean, technology transfer into those kind of high-risk places, you know, I guess the sanctions list is getting warmed up lately. And
it is,
you
know, right?
As they're there, they may as well add a whole bunch of other things.
So this is a conversation I had with someone else just recently. I sort of described to them the change in the US government since Biden came to office. One of the big changes is an influx of what I call the grant recipient set. So these are the people who've been waiting in the wings in think tanks and whatever. And now they're in there, they're in the bureaucracies. And I think that's partially, you know, them being there combined with political will to do stuff like this, I think is what's making the difference. I think this sort of activity largely took a breather under the Trump administration, with the, you know, notable exception of things like broader sanctions on, you know, China and Russia.
Yes, I mean, there was a lot more Twitter shouting and a lot less kind of, you know, effective sanctions or effective response. Like, we think about the mess with TikTok, for example, where it really just wasn't clear what they were trying to achieve. And like, let's sell TikTok to Oracle for national security reasons. Just, you know, like, it was comedic. Whereas a company that's, you know, dealing with quantum computing tech for the Chinese military, like, that, I can, that makes sense. I can draw a line. Like, there's some sense in this.
It seems, know, logic, like, in this. It's just funny when you contrast the approach, right? I know. The whole thing in retrospect seems like a fever dream, right? And I know I'm going to get email for saying that, but it's just, it was, what a time that was.
I mean, Oracle TikTok, like, it doesn't make any sense.
Anyway, some good news for a change. Interpol, by the looks of things, we got a report here from Tim Starks at Cyberscoop on this. It looks like Interpol coordinated a pretty decent law enforcement action against all sorts of online scammers who are doing things like romance scams, investment fraud, and also BEC, money laundering associated with illegal online gambling. So basically just all flavors of like low-end internet shitfuckery, basically. And this Interpol operation wrapped up and there were 1,003 people arrested. They only intercepted $27 million, which seems kind of low considering the high numbers of arrests, but it's good to see the hammer come down on some of these lower level scammers because they do a lot of harm.
They really do. This campaign, dubbed HE2, ran across something like 20 countries between June and September this year. And as you say, 1,000 people arrested, a bunch of bank accounts related to money laundering and, you know, money muling. And a few kind of, you know, good news stories of like companies that have been saved from bankruptcy because the operation managed to intercept some business email compromise payments. So yeah, nice to see actual police work happening. Nice to see some arrests. And like the amount of coordination required to do this across 20 countries, I mean, that also is a set of skills and connections and processes that, you know, once you exercise them, then they will become easier next time. So, I mean, good news, even if the, you know, the amount of money that we were talking about wasn't necessarily as huge as some of the things we've seen.
Well, I'm guessing a lot of the bank accounts they got, you know, they would have shut down a bunch of muling accounts, and most of them already, the money would have gone through, right? So,
yes.
You know, onwards to wherever. Staying with law enforcement action, and Adam Bannister for the Daily Swig reports that Ukrainian police have rounded up some, what they're calling a phone hacking collective, but it's not really clear from the story exactly what they were doing, because they're saying it was like some sort of phishing scheme that was used to hack into target devices. And I'm thinking, well, how does that work?
Yeah, the report's a little bit unclear. It says they were like selling access to other people's phones, or, you know, offering to hack people's phones for money and extracting the data. Also, you know, hacking people's phones and then just kind of on selling the data. They do also talk about stolen phones and, you know, I imagine that kind of like if you can hack someone's phone, get the key material necessary to then, you know, resell the phone, wipe it on iCloud, lock it.
See, that's what I thought as well, because quite often, like, there's organized gangs in places like Brazil where if you steal someone's iPhone, you can go to these crews who will then bombard the owner of that phone with legit-looking phishing emails for find my iPhone or whatever, right? And then you can capture their creds that way and often unlock the device and then on-sell it. So I wondered if that was it, but it's just not a very clear report.
No, and I think Adam Bannister did say in the piece that they've reached out to the Ukrainian security services to try and get some more information about the particular cases. But yeah, I think in general, if you've got the ability to use phones and compromise phones, then yeah, there's a bunch of different crime types you can engage in. Yeah. And maybe it's just a case of like you've got a hammer and you can, you know, hit a bunch of different nails with it and they're all criminals. So why not arrest them?
It also made me think, though, because this wasn't clear, I'm like, well, does it really matter? Because these days, the account is the device, you know, your device is just an extension of the edge of the cloud into your pocket, you know. Things have changed, I guess, is what
I'm getting at. Yeah, all the authors integrated with your phone and biometrics and automagical and tied in with your SIM card. Yeah, this ecosystem is much more glued together, and I suppose maybe the crime types are a little less distinct than they used to be.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Everything's blurring. Tonya Riley for CyberScoop has a write-up here, and I just think this is an interesting sign of the times write-up. She's writing about a somewhat obscure ransomware crew. She describes them as under the radar, but they're rebranding. They use Reddit as their way to publish information and whatnot instead of running their own infrastructure. I think they used to have a portal, but essentially what this story is saying is that this crew is trying to fly under the radar to avoid attracting attention from authorities, and that is, I gotta say, it's a good sign of the times, because we have seen a lot of these major league crews being somewhat less active lately. And it's interesting that the smaller crews too are being just a little bit more careful. So cautiously optimistic here, Adam.
Yeah, I think that's the right conclusion to draw here, because the you know, once you get too big and have too much of a name for yourself and too much visibility, then the pressure starts to mount up. And yes, you can run your own infrastructure. And if your OPSEC is perfect all the time, then maybe that's a great solution. But as we all know, OPSEC is pretty hard. And the fact that, you know, groups would want to stay small, stay niche, you know, this group, for example, we are rebranding constantly, or rebranding so as to, you know, avoid drawing too many lines to their past activities so that they get attention. And yeah, I mean, using Reddit or using other services instead of running your own infrastructure, that makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. But yeah, you're right. The fact that that is an approach that seems like the right choice implies that the pressure that we're, you know, have been starting to bring to bear maybe is, you know, impacting how they're thinking and how they're planning, and, you know, whether they can scale. I guess that's the point, is to not scale, right? To keep it low.
Yeah, that's the whole point of suppression, right? to make them do this. But let's see how sustainable it is. I mean, you know, as I've often said, I think, you know, ransomware suppression needs to be an ongoing activity with some involvement from military and intelligence agencies, but it'll never completely go away. But if you can get them second-guessing their expansion plans, that's a win. And all evidence is just anecdotal at this point that that's even happening. You know, lots of smaller targets, still schools, still hospitals, things like that. So still a grim situation, but it doesn't feel like a crisis just at the moment, does it? And that's kind of a new feeling.
Yeah, like not this week. You know, maybe next week, maybe 2 weeks ago, not this week.
Although I will say that I had a conversation with a journalist at a sort of mainstream media outlet quite recently, where he told me that getting a ransomware story up at the moment where he works is actually quite difficult, because it's sort of, as a topic, it's been played out. People know what it is, right? There's no editors aren't interested in running a story about just another ransomware incident. So that's one of the reasons that we haven't seen it as much in the news, is just because the media isn't covering it to the same degree. So it is still very, it's like Omicron, right? Like where we are with Omicron, however you want to say it. Like, we just don't know yet. We don't have the data.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, over, it's, you know, it's probably going to take us a couple of years to really see the impact of some of the work that started to happen, you know, and some of the hounds that have been released. Then we'll be able to judge where we are.
Well, and Joe Tidy from the BBC, turns out he's a bit of a trendsetter, because, you know, he trudged through Russia looking for some of these ransomware people. And the Daily Mail has apparently tracked one of these Revil affiliates, like one of the ones who's like really wanted by the FBI and whatever. They tracked Yevgeny Polyanin. He's 28 years old, to a, quote, chic $380,000 home in Siberia, where he was seen driving a Land Cruiser 200. Good choice, by the way, Yevgeny, as an Australian who lives in a regional area. Very good choice for your ill-gotten gains. But yeah, another one of these stories where they've like tracked down one of these guys and they're like, they're living, you know, openly enjoying a luxury lifestyle, blah, 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 blah. And it's written, and it's like, you know, Joe did his like, you know, very BBC, but this is like proper tabloid, this one.
It really is. Yeah. It's so great. I mean, you know, the idea that a tabloid newspaper is, you know, going around and, you know, for example, this guy's wife makes like cupcakes with cupcakes on them for hen's parties. And so they've got like pictures of her cupcakes with male genitalia, as described, you know, very primly by the Daily Mail. But yeah, this idea that we can just go to, like, you know, we can't arrest these people, we can't extradite them from Russia, but we can send journalists to go talk to their mums. And, you know, much like Joe Tidy talking to the other guy's dad, like, yeah, they went and interviewed the mum and said, how are you feeling about the fact that your son's got a bounty on his head from the US government? And she said that she's been taking pills because it makes her feel bad. Yeah. And so, like, that's what you did to your poor, you know, babushka. Horrible man. But yeah, it's a, like a good quality Krebsing in a way. Like, they've just gone through and like doxed where he went to school and talked to his professors at university and pictures of him, you know, of his birthday cake. Like, and decided that he likes some particular Japanese manga series as a result of his birthday cake. And they have drone footage of his house. Like, they flew a drone around his house and they got like all these pictures. They got pictures of him like driving out of his driveway in his Land Cruiser and going off to, you know, get some etchki or whatever he's doing, whatever shopping errand he has. Pictures of his mom and pictures of his sister. And yes, like, back of the full Krebs experience, but in tabloid style. And I got to say, I'm here for this. Like, this is...
Well, it turns out $380,000 US buys you quite a nice apartment in Siberia.
Yeah, they got pictures from like the real estate, I guess the real estate listing, or maybe it's one of the other houses in the same complex. But yeah, it's pretty, pretty flash looking pad.
It is. I mean, $380,000 US won't buy you a parking space in Sydney. So there you go. And look, Kim Zetter, and this, you know, connects to the story we were just talking about. Kim Zetter has just done a smashing job on her Substack, in her Substack newsletter, and we're linking through to this. It's a very long story, but it's really looking at how the United States, there was a period when the United States and Russia did cooperate on cybercrime. And so she's written, you know, some historical stuff about that and sort of looking at the current situation, whatever. It's just really, really good work.
Yeah, it was really great context and kind of talks through the fall of the Soviet Union and then the initial kind of relationship between the FBI and, you know, Russian authorities. You know, has some personal kind of anecdotes about, you know, going down to the Lubyanka to meet with the FSB and Putin, hanging out and watching the meetings because he was nosy. And also talks through some of the investigations done by other authorities in the US, like the US Postal Service, for example, investigating mail fraud. And some of the relationships they had with Russia, and, you know, the stories of people who've been arrested, you know, as they've been in Ukraine or going to traveling to other countries around the world. And we've seen that as a tool they've used quite effectively. But yeah, really a great wrap up of some of that historical aspects, and then talks about, you know, why now things have changed, like that kind of process, the gradual process of cooperation dying out and being replaced now with, you know, the situation where we, you know, there is just no cooperation, at least as far as cybercrime is concerned, you know, with the Russians. So yeah, great wrap up, some really interesting tidbits in there, and definitely worth the quite long read.
Yeah, so who knows? I mean, maybe we'll get back there one day. I can't see it happening soon, but you never know. We've got a fantastic story published on the record here by a freelance reporter from Nigeria called Olatunji Olaib. I'm guessing that's the pronunciation of their name. But yes, the headline is "How the Pandemic Pulled Nigerian University Students into Cybercrime." And this is just such a wonderful, colourful feature.
It's a great read. And, you know, we've often talked about, you know, the relationship between inequality and cybercrime, you know, that these are tools that, you know, when you've got education and access to the internet, but not very many opportunities, then cybercrime is a really natural place to go. And this is a personal, you know, in many cases, a personal story because the person writing it is at a university where there are a bunch of students that have been engaging in cybercrime, and talks through, you know, what the effect the pandemic had on opportunities and university courses and how some people fell into crime, but also the kind of the wider Nigerian cultural context for what they call the Yahoo boys, right? The people who did a lot of the early internet scamming. I mean, to the extent that, you know, the vernacular 419 scam for you know, the Nigerian print scammers, like 419 is the Nigerian criminal code for that, you know, for that particular sort of computer crime. The fact we call it that kind of shows how important Nigeria has been in the history of this kind of cybercrime. So yeah, it's a really good story that pulls together those social aspects, the on the ground kind of insight. You know, the person who wrote this piece, you know, is friends with and knows some of the people who've been doing this sort of thing, and talks about, you know, the effect that it has on their, you know, how they see the world and how they perceive, you know, how they justify, make the moral arguments for, you know, taking money from the West, given the level of inequality and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's a really, really great piece. And I, you know, I really do love seeing this kind of on the ground local understanding and context explained so that we can see the full picture of why we are where we are, like why BEC scams are like that, and you know what's on the other end of this.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting too in the Daily Mail story about Pollyannan. There's a line in there, and I'll just read it to you. And this is talking about Pollyannan's mum. Despite his plush new home valued at $380,000, and they just love to say that it's worth $380,000 and frequently do in this story, Pollyannan remains officially registered at her grim Soviet-era flat in a block originally built for Interior Ministry employees such as police in Barnaul. Apart from her iPhone 8, his mother shows no signs of wealth. Now, in what universe is rocking an iPhone 8 a sign of wealth?
Well, I mean, maybe Barnaul, Siberia, but...
Yes, maybe.
But I don't know.
I guess that's the point, right? Like, it doesn't let these people off the hook. It doesn't mean they're not culpable, but it certainly is a driver. You would have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, it is. One of the things that caught my eye in the piece about Nigeria was a statistic that said during the COVID outbreak, 69% of households reported reducing their food consumption because they couldn't afford food because of the loss of opportunities because of the pandemic. And like, if you're making a choice between, you know, do my kids eat or does my sick grandma eat, or can I, you know, go rip off Americans?
Mm.
You know, well, there's a music video from like a local Nigerian artist, you know, which is kind of the Nigerian equivalent of like American gangster rap glorifying, you know, guns and drugs. But in this case, it's glorifying that kind of Yahoo boy, you know, cybercrime lifestyle, which of course it makes sense that such things exists.
But that's the real nerdcore.
Well, yes, right. And I remember I was watching it, and of course the music is 100% not my style, but I was thinking, like, as a kid I grew up and, you know, Cypress Hill was the big new thing, or like American West Coast gangster rap was a thing that was being, you know, in the world around me as a teenager. And if I could go back in time and tell teenage metal that the stuff that you're into, like hacking and things, would be the subject of future gangster rap, like, that would have just, like, how would you even conceive of that?
It's a funny old world, isn't it?
It really is.
Moving on, we've got a story here from Matt Burgess at Wired, and it's a nice wrap-up of the recent tit-for-tat activity between Iran and Israel in the cybers. You know, we've seen petrol stations getting owned. We've seen the railway system disrupted. What's interesting, though, is this story cites some research from Checkpoint that says that those attacks against the rail system in Iran, it doesn't look like, to them at least, that the Israeli government was involved. Keep in mind too that Checkpoint is an Israeli vendor, but I don't think they'd be, you know, covering up for their government. I think that's kind of unlikely. They're just saying, yeah, that probably wasn't the government. Whereas the more recent attacks on the fuel infrastructure and whatnot, that probably was. Is that about the long and the short of it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, that particular piece of Checkpoint research, they concluded that it was a group that had also been seen active in Syria and didn't appear to be state linked. And I think you're right that, like, if Checkpoint wanted to cover for the Israeli government, they would have not said anything, as opposed to putting out a statement saying that it wasn't, right? But yeah, the other thing that stood out to me reading this story was, you know, this is described as a tit for tat, right? It's the conflict between Iran and Israel. And yet when you look at the list of operations conducted by the Israelis here, like, you know, gas stations and container ports and, you know, some, you know, even kind of cyber physical things where there's, you know, been some, like there was that fire at Natanz recently in the, like, power substation or whatever. And then you compare that to the list of operations attributed to the Iranians in this, like leaking personal data from an Israeli, you know, LGBTQ dating app, or that one we had recently with the, you know, defense minister's cleaner taking photos of his desk or whatever. Like, the level of, I mean, the only one that really that the Iranians carried out that, you know, looked like it had real potential was that you know, water treatment, you know, chlorination, adjusting the chlorination levels, things which Israel responded to with a, you know, attack on the ports in Iran. But it didn't really look very tit for tat, I guess, is where I'm going. Like, the Iranian operations looked pretty clumsy by comparison to, you know, some pretty professional stuff out of Israel.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's that, what is it, a bit of a fuck around and find out sort of situation, you know?
Yeah, I think so.
But I don't think that's going to mean I think they're going to be slow learners on this. You know, I'm not expecting this thing to de-escalate anytime soon. How about you?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it's been going on for a while, and I don't know that, you know, we've tried a lot of things to de-escalate this situation and we haven't got very far yet. So, yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. Now, turning our attention to China, another story here from Dina Temple-Raston, and a Chinese regulator has told Tencent that their apps, its apps, have to be vetted and approved before they go into app stores. So this is like a government vetting process. But they're doing things like checking the apps for compliance with their new privacy regime and whatnot. Now, the reason I bring this up is because in last week's newsletter, because it was a slow week last week as well, Tom Yuren, who's our newsletter writer, had an excuse to write about Chinese regulation and legislation around cybersecurity, data protection, and privacy. And the resulting piece is called Cyber Regulation with Chinese Characteristics. And it's a really interesting look. If you want to understand news stories like the one that we're just talking about now, which is, you know, Chinese government agencies vetting apps, if you think that's all about spooky business and getting in people's lives, well, it's not necessarily so. The true picture is somewhat nuanced. Did you read Tom's story?
Yes. Yeah, it is a really good kind of write-up of the steps that they've taken. And there's like three different sets of laws that he refers to that kind of explain what they're trying to do and the steps they've taken to do it, and kind of talks through the, you know, the relationship between the kind of commercial aspects of it, like how private sector companies are required to handle information. So that's sort of the equivalent of the GDPR, but perhaps better, I don't know. And then the national security aspects, you know, where the national security apparatus essentially is the one in charge overall and really gets to make the decisions, which kind of explains some of their big picture thinking. And also kind of how it ties into you know, the Chinese Communist Party's sort of vision of how they should control things. Like, we've seen a bit of argy-bargy between the tech industry in China and the government where, you know, they want to make very clear who's the boss. And, you know, a company like Tencent, you know, is definitely one of the bigger operations in China. And them being visibly seen to comply with this stuff is pretty important for, I imagine, public perception in China. So, yeah, really good kind of set of frameworks which you can hang these stories on when you're trying to understand it.
Well, that's the thing, is we've seen so much coverage of China passed this law or China's implementing this regulation, but no one really doing much analysis about why, right? And so you see the reactionary takes that say China's just doing this so that it's got a stick to hit the private sector around with. Well, it's already had sticks like that. Like, it ordered Didi removed from app stores, you know, because it displeased them. So, you know, the idea that this is about state control and capture, like, that's redundant at this point. So will it be used as a stick? Probably, but that's not the primary motivation. And I think Tom did a really good job of capturing that nuance. And I think one of the really interesting things too is that their restrictions on algorithms, right? Because Chinese leaders have looked at what's happened in the West with YouTube manufacturing Nazis and have said, maybe we don't want that. So basically, if you're going to have algorithmically promoted and selected content, it needs to be in line with party values. Now, you know, most Western analysts will look at that and say, this is about propagating communism, but maybe it's just about not propagating division, you know? So it really just does depend on the way you look at it.
Yeah, I mean, Chinese are very big on promoting harmony, right? A harmonious society.
If you're Han Chinese, yes.
if you're Han Chinese, yes. and so, yeah, like you do see it fit together. And I think in some ways, like, you look at the laws they're passing and you compare that to, like, say, the patchwork of privacy between Western privacy laws between Western countries or tech laws in Western countries. And it's kind of hard not to look at it and go, it seems like they've done a pretty reasonable job. I mean, you know,
there's probably some stuff we can learn.
Yes, here, I think, like, there really is. And I mean, especially in the US, where, you know, the kind of laws to control private sector operations and how they handle data are, you know, not effective. You got to look at this and go, yeah, like, I do got to hand it to them on this particular one because it does seem reasonable. And it'll be interesting to see, like, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, how effective it's been.
And there are some national security aspects to it, which you couldn't do in the United, like, you know, making companies send their apps to the government first before approval. But, you know, it's going to serve China's interests. It's going to serve the party's interests. Let's put it that way, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, just an interesting topic. So for anyone who's really interested in the state of these laws in China, and there's a bunch of different perspectives in that story. Tom spoke to Dr. Samantha Hoffman from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, spoke to Adam Siegel, the director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council of Foreign Relations, also spoke to Associate Professor Henry Gao of Singapore Management University. So, you know, it's a really good piece. I've plugged it enough. It's in this week's show notes. Go get it. And if you have not subscribed to our newsletter, that's the sort of stuff you're missing. So there you go. Looks like the legislation in the United States that would require critical infrastructure owners to report major cyber incidents to the federal government. This is a piece of law that also mandates that ransomware victims disclose when they make payments. Looks like it's hit a bit of a snag in the US Senate, mostly because some, I think, Republican lawmakers are suggesting that it should only be critical infrastructure operators who are required to report ransomware incidents, which is really cuts against what this act is trying to do, which is to pull together statistics on how much of a problem ransomware is so that they can formulate policy responses. So it's a bit of a mess right now is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, it is. And given like last week we were talking about this particular piece of legislation, and you know, overall it seems pretty positive. And I think, you know, there would be a bunch of good things that would happen from it going through as it was, you know, when we talked about it. I think in typical US fashion, this is tied to the National Defense Authorization Act, the one where you put like every single bit of legislation you want to get passed for every bridge that needs building for whatever reason, you know, all gets bogged together into one law that you can't not pass. So it's that kind of thing where it's bogged down. And as you say, we need good data to be able to have the right legislative approach and to be able to handle this. And yeah, anything that reduces the amount of organizations that are in scope or that do have to report, I think does lower the value of it.
Catalin Kimpanu reports for the Record that you know, some North Korean APT crew was posing as Samsung recruiters to target security researchers. No surprises there. You know, I admire the North Koreans' chutzpah in going after. I mean, if you can't write elite exploits yourself, you know, get half of the way there and then dangle it as a collaboration opportunity, right? Which is one of the ways they were doing this, or pretend to be a chick on LinkedIn or whatever it is, right? And now pretend to be a Samsung recruiter. Hey, whatever works. I like the fact that this, you know, global espionage and intrigue just really looks like 90s hacking, right? 90s black hattery. It's so funny.
It does, yeah. And this campaign is funny because they are the elite technique that they were using here is they were sending, you know, people who worked in tech, exploit writers and things, a broken PDF. And then when you replied saying, hey, I can't open the PDF because, you know, I put it in my sandbox PDF reader and it doesn't work, they would say, oh, well, here's a link to a more secure PDF reader that you need to be able to see this super secret PDF. And then they would send you a link to a Trojaned existing, like, open source PDF reader that had a backdoor in it. And, yeah, get you that way, which... When you're going after exploit researchers?
I mean, why not, right? Like, I think there's so many more people in exploit writing these days. Not all of them are going to be 1990s grade paranoid, right? So you might actually get a few this way.
You may get some people with Samsung.rar, which, you know.
It's always .rar, right? Have you noticed that? Like .rar has just become such a red flag.
Yeah.
So funny. Another one from Catalin here. There's an FBI document circulating that shows what type of data can be obtained from encrypted messaging apps. And it's much what you'd expect. And I think this is stuff that we all mostly knew already, but it's nice seeing it in one place. It's sort of like the lawful access guidance for FBI agents. Like, here's what you can get from WhatsApp. Here's what you can get from Wicca, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, Signal is, you know, the champ on the chart because all you can get is like, I think, what is it? The
like time, last login time.
Yeah, last login time is about it. But you know, I was surprised actually that with iMessage you don't get full pen register or metadata. You just get like number and user lookups between two users, but not actually when they sent messages. But of course, you can snag the whole lot if they're using iCloud backups. So again, it's much what you'd expect, but it is interesting seeing it in a document.
Yeah, I don't think there's any individual piece of information that wasn't, you know, already public knowledge here, but having a very easy to use chart that explains the differences between the different messaging providers and the different kind of warrant standards, you know, from a subpoena up to, you know, a search warrant or a court order or whatever else. Like, it's a very good reference. And so if you are, you know, considering where to carry out your criminal activity, then it might be a useful chart to consult.
Yeah, there's a FOI from Property of the People, a US nonprofit dedicated to government transparency. And crime. Just kidding.
And crime, yes. Useful information for criminals. So, yes, the only downside is, of course, it's a very bad, like, fax or something of the document. So the text is a little rubbish. Catalan has gone to the effort of transcribing it all for you, so it's more searchable as actual text. So thank you, Catalan.
Yeah, it looks like it was scanned by a potato, basically. Yes. So yeah,
a one-bit potato.
A one-bit potato. What else have we got here? AT&T was getting rinsed by the looks of things. This is another Catalan one. They had a whole bunch of these Edgemark Enterprise Session Border Controllers. These are a voice over IP server that do like load balancing and routing for internet telephony. And there's thousands of these. And it says on AT&T's network, but I'm not sure if that's their corporate network or their actual network that they operate. But apparently, there was some research that came out of Chihu 360 that led to AT&T like realizing they had something like 6,000 VoIP servers inside its network that were rinsed by a DDoS crew. So thanks, China.
Yeah, that's some good work spotting this one. It wasn't clear, as you said, whether it was core network, whether it was like customer edge, whether it was like customer premise equipment. But net result is VoIP systems are usually well connected. And in this case, the bug that was being used to deploy this, it was a pretty full-featured kind of botnet agent, was a like 2017 like straight up command. Well, it's not even command injection. It had a feature to just execute a command as root on the underlying Linux, like in the web interface. Nice. And you could just direct object reference to the particular page that had the like type your command in the input box and press execute sort of thing. So yeah, real top quality software there. The vendor did patch it at the time, but I mean, this is the sort of equipment that no one ever looks at and no one is clear who's responsible for. So yeah, not surprising.
Now, if you're a Zoom user and you had your feelings hurt or whatever by them marketing their product as end-to-end encrypted when it wasn't, if you're eligible, you should have got an email by now, but Zoom users, paid users are eligible for a compensation, Adam, up to $25 or $15 if they weren't a paid subscriber. And all you got to do is like fill in a form, a physical form, and get it to them. And I think you'll get your money, I think, sometime next year, in March next year, according to this story by Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai over at Motherboard.
Yes, I think if you were a paid subscriber and you paid a lot, then maybe you can get up to 15% back. If you're a real high roller Zoom user, that didn't apply to like extra add-on features or like optional things. It was only like if you were, as you say, offended by the lack of end-to-end crypto in the style that they had advertised. Big high roller settlement right there. And and of course, it only applies to Americans. Us, foreigners do not deserve to have $15 for using Zoom without end-to-end crypto.
Now, this one, I don't know if this is really so much a security story versus just something funny happening on the internet, but someone is spamming network-attached receipt printers that are unauthed with the anti-work manifesto from Reddit. Which is an interesting little bit of activism, I guess, if you want to call it that. Like, you know, so you're just at work at your retail or hospitality job and the receipt printer starts spitting out instructions on unionizing, you know.
And like useful legal advice about, you know, how to challenge your employer, you know, who tries to curtail you from talking about your salary or wages with your coworkers, and, you know, a bunch of steps you might like to take during your break, such as unionizing. It's funny because they're sending them, you know, the messages are formatted correctly for receipt printers, which is a nice touch. You know, they're not just spamming every printer on the internet. Like this is, you know, slightly more well thought through for Reddit. Kind of funny. And of course, the Reddit threads are filled with people who work retail and are having them spit out of their printers nonstop and having quite a jolly laugh.
Yes. Now, before we go, Adam, we're just going to have a quick chat about something that you pasted into our sort of, company Slack earlier today, which is AWS is now offering its customers the tools to deploy, manage, and scale private cellular networks, specifically 5G networks. And the funny thing is everybody had the same reaction when you pasted it in, which is what a stupid idea. And then, oh, hang on, that actually makes sense, right? So that's why I wanted to talk about it, because I figure everyone's going to have the same reaction where you think, why on earth would you need a 5G network? And then you think, well, mine sites, ports, et cetera. There's actually quite a lot of places where you can't really do Wi-Fi and that don't have cell coverage or the cell coverage is not that good. So, of course, spinning up your own 5G network, which is on unlicensed spectrum in the United States, like, you know, license-free spectrum in the United States, like, why would you not roll your own 5G?
I know, and I had exactly that whiplash reading it. Because, I mean, you always read these new Amazon service announcements, AWS service announcements, and you're like, oh, who's ever going to use a, you know, Amazon AWS horse whisperer or whatever dumb name it happens to be? Because they never have a relationship to the actual product that they're selling. Although this one's called Private 5G, which I guess, as Amazon naming standards go, is pretty much
bang on.
They have lifted their game. But yeah, you just have this complete whiplash of, actually, you know what? Setting up and running your own mobile network is a real pain. And you can do it, of course, with hobbyist gear. But, I mean, if you wanted to do it for a business, that's not a thing you'd ever actually suggest. You'd try and roll some nasty Cisco Enterprise Wi-Fi thing, and it would never be exactly what you wanted. And, of course, being able to use mobile devices, like plug a SIM card in, and all of a sudden now all of the mobile or IoT devices that were going to use the public cell network and get wrecked, you can now run on your own private network, and all you got to do is swap a SIM. Like, that sounds amazing. And then Amazon ships you pre-configured cell sites, like microcells, and you just bung them around, and they do all the radio management, they run all of the HLR and the other, you know, plumbing of the network. It's actually a really great idea.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, MineSight, even though they only operate, what is it, about 1,000 feet and 300 meters, I think last time I checked was about the range of a 5G cell. But, you know, you get a battery, a solar panel, one of these cells, and a pole, and you just mesh it, and it's going to work.
Yeah, I mean, and this is kind of, you know, the idea of 5G networks converging much more towards regular, you know, IT tech and IP networking tech and virtualization and, you know, the sort of dynamic allocation of resources that we're more used to in the IT world. And of course, AWS really kind of pioneered a lot of that. It makes a lot of sense, actually. And
yeah.
I was thinking, like, you remember the Mexican drug cartels that ran their own 2G GSM network?
Thing. Yeah, they were building, but I mean, I guess they were trying to cover a larger area, right? They weren't trying to cover a port or a mine site. They were trying to cover the valley that they defended with their anti-aircraft guns, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, like, no longer do they have to rely on, you know, some one guy who's then going to rat them out to the FBI when he gets arrested 5 years later. No, now they can buy a scalable turnkey solution from Amazon. So
I think drug cartels turning to Amazon for their telephony needs would be music to the ears of the DEA, actually,
yeah,
Adam.
Probably.
all right, Adam, that is actually it for this week's news. As I say, a bit of a different sort of week, you know, much more feature content, much less talking about the world burning. So that's been a lot of fun, actually. It's like getting an invisible massage talking about the news this week.
Yeah,
it's been
refreshing.
A real pleasure, my friend, and we'll do it all again next week, which is our last show for the year.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the last show of the year and then a big gap when everything gets ruined. So, yes, I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It is time for our sponsor interview with Ryan Callenber of Proofpoint now. He is the EVP of cybersecurity strategy there, and he's joining me this week to talk about how investment activity in cybersecurity is basically leaving everyone who isn't a mega enterprise behind. Here's Ryan Callenber.
Yeah, I think you could even look at the market segments that are attracting the dollars right now. Right. And many of them have things like detection and response in their names, whether that's old-fashioned EDR at this point, or NDR, or now it's CDR for cloud detection and response, and of course XDR if you can't decide which of the DRs you prefer. The key thing that assumes, though, is that there is somebody to do the responding. And for the vast majority of organizations, that's just simply not the case. So those who really have specific requirements for how they're going to execute their multi-cloud security strategy, they are probably getting their needs served, and they're getting the work of some of the best engineers in all of cybersecurity, and not really trickling down to everybody else.
But this is a long-standing problem in security, right? Which is smaller businesses. Even, you know, companies that are quite large and profitable, like if you owned that company, you'd be happy because you'd be very, very wealthy sort of thing, right? Like, so we're not talking about ma and pa stores, but even in that mid-level of market, no one's really ever catered to that market. And no one's ever succeeded really in catering to that market because they generally don't have dedicated security budgets, right? So, you know, on one level, I totally agree with your observation, which is all of the investment is going towards that upper end of the market, but that's because that's the only part of the market that spends money.
That's entirely correct. And I think there are a couple of things that give me hope long-term that this might change. to your point, though, you're absolutely correct. It's even true for our revenue, right? We have 165,000 or so SMB customers, and it's not a big percentage of our annual turnover, which is also helps us prioritize our own engineering resources. So that disconnect is always there, and the market forces haven't necessarily realigned. But if you look at kind of the things in security that ultimately work, if it works for an organization that does not have dedicated staff, that does not have a Microsoft MVP, you know, in-house in order to configure things, it will probably work everywhere else too. Right now, though, we do have this unfortunate set of incentives that makes us build ever more complicated things to secure the more complicated environments. And we haven't done necessarily the sort of reset that I think of Apple, right? In terms of how they handle operating systems and devices and everything else like that. They're not building for enterprise, but it has actually been, I think, an incredibly positive development for enterprise in general to kind of start from that consumer mindset and work upward. It's not really happened that way in security, though.
Well, I can think of a few instances where it has. Like, I think Google Workspaces, you know, or what did they call it, G Suite or whatever. I mean, that is an example of essentially something that started as a consumer product that wound up being, you know, a smaller, I don't know, it is an enterprise product, really, even though the enterprise sales suck. but you know, that's a good example there.
No, totally. And I guess Yubico is a good example. There's lots of things that work perfectly well for consumers that also work well for the enterprise. But it's not what's attracting most of the brightest minds in cybersecurity. It's not where the funding dollars are going. It's not where the M&A is going. It's not where we are putting our emphasis.
Now, speaking of funding, right? There was a round recently that raised your eyebrow. You told me about it. Now, I understand if you don't want to say this on mic, you know, because you were like, geez, that's a lot of dollars. But if you're comfortable with talking about this funding round that you mentioned to me, what was it?
Yeah, no, I mentioned the Laceworks round. Lacework is the name of the company. It's a $1.3 billion round. And that's staggering for lots of reasons, right? That's greater than the annual revenues of all but a small handful of cybersecurity companies. It's almost greater than our annual revenues. And we're in the top five. It's staggering that much money would be thrown at a problem. And the problem it's being thrown at is the multi-cloud one I alluded to earlier. There's, you know, yes, cloud security is a challenge at enterprise scale. A lot of organizations are using AWS, GCP, and Azure, and have to do a lot of work to make all of that configured correctly. And it is a genuinely large market if you assume that some percentage of cloud workloads are going to need a third-party security product attached to them. But to your point earlier, this is the sort of cycle that keeps attracting massive amounts of investment because, you know, Wiz came before them, and you know, they're doing really interesting research on specific cloud databases in Azure. But is that what your average organization, and forget the mom and pop shops, is that your average 1,000 person organization's chief security problem?
Well, that's kind of the organization that I was describing earlier, where I'm like, they're not a huge enterprise, but you'd be happy if you owned a company that size.
Yeah, no, totally. You know? And that's what's gotten really interesting. I think, you know, we spent the last one of these slamming Microsoft, and it's worth giving them a little bit of credit here, given what they've done with Defender for Business, kind of moving it to a simple slider style approach for how you configure the thing, and also actually getting it to block stuff as opposed to just running in traditional EDR detection and then somebody's got to respond to it mode.
It's interesting that everyone's moving towards XDR at the moment, because I'm with you on that, which is that I think there's too much of an emphasis on detection right now because people have put prevention in the too hard basket. Again, This lets me plug Airlock, who I'm working with, because they are purely, you know, a prevention-based company, and it's not actually too hard to do that, which is, I think people gave up on prevention, particularly in a Windows context, maybe a little bit too early. But that begs the question, like, what are the solutions for, you know, what's going to help that slightly more downmarket part of the, you know, of the wider sort of IT ecosystem? What are the products that they need?
It's a really good point, though, because that's exactly what they need. They need prevention. They aren't going to have the ability to do the response themselves, and they aren't going to be able to do anything with the detections. So if you think of what that means, you know, obviously I mentioned the 165,000 of our customers, you know, they're not using the CASB, they're not using DLP, they're using email security and just making sure fewer threats are delivered. a lot of them are actually using things like security awareness training, as you know, somewhat non-technical as that sounds, but that does obviously scale down market. There are other things, though, that I think from the perspective of what you mentioned earlier, Google Workspace is a great choice. You know, YubiKeys would go a long way. AirLock actually is a phenomenal idea for anybody who's interested in moving more in the prevention direction. But all of those are swimming against the tide right now in terms of how the overall security industry is going. And I think to your point, they're swimming against the time.
They're swimming against the industry. I don't know if they're swimming against the market, which is kind of the ironic thing here. But anyway, this is an interview about them. So, of course, Proofpoint has been acquired into the Borg collective that is Thoma Bravo. Now, the thinking is, I'm guessing that they're going to make a few changes, try to get revenue up, and then probably relist the company because that's kind of their playbook. So I'm guessing that, you know, if this is a topic that you chose, a topic that you want to talk about, then better serving that sort of medium-sized business market is probably something Proofpoint's taking a look at?
I think the strategy is evolving in a couple of those different directions. To your earlier point, we're absolutely focusing more on prevention because even fairly large organizations that we talk to, you might even have somebody carrying around a CISO title that has no direct reports. That's happened a couple of times. So, you know, who is going to consume this API of glorious threat data that we're producing?
It's like me calling myself the executive vice president of content creation for Risky Biz.
Exactly. and ultimately, the prevention thing is something that we think we and the industry in general can do a lot more work around and ultimately have some really positive consequences. The other thing that I would note there actually is web isolation was something that we acquired our way into a couple of years ago. It's one of our fastest growing products. You know, we're rewriting mostly links in emails and things, but you know, those sort of preventative measures have really taken off. But to your point around the strategy, there's two big things that we are trying to do differently. One, we realized that we were absolutely building for Fortune 100, mostly America's headquartered organizations. And ultimately, that's not everybody. So we are opening up a lot of different markets that we didn't do a great job serving before, especially throughout APJ and even some in Europe as well, throughout the Middle East. The other piece of the strategy there, though, is to just make it more about the customer outcome than the tech in a lot of cases. So the only acquisition we've done in 2021 was actually a managed services company that has 150 plus people who just do DLP. They make it successful in real environments, whether that is a deployment, an implementation, very often not even with all our tech, and of course ongoing managed services, which for most organizations is something that they never really operationalized around DLP.
Managed services have sort of been the you know, the village idiot for a long time in this industry, but I feel like that's kind of changing. And one of the reasons that's changing is because the tools that they have access to now are much better. They are. I mean, you can actually
totally.
You don't need to TeamViewer everyone anymore.
No, that is absolutely true. And one of the very, very first things I did in my cybersecurity career in like 2000, 2001, was try and actually build out MSS-type technology. We're using Snort and all these little 1U boxes. And it was somewhat depressing to actually wander into an MSSP, I think it was about 3 years ago, and kind of see the
same,
exact
stuff.
I'd be like, oh, wow, I could sit down and be a tier one again. That would be a bizarre sort of PTSD to experience. But
I think there's been improvements in stuff like, you know, managed EDR isn't cripplingly expensive anymore. And you've got endpoint management and stuff. Like even managed patching is something like they would just take your money and not do it previously. They'd miss half your boxes. Right. But now it's, I don't know, it's just, I feel like that side of it's got a lot better.
Oh, it absolutely has. And that's really been, I think, in the last 3 years or so. And that is another really good development because that scales down. Smaller organizations can absolutely benefit from that. And it also actually benefits the bigger organizations. I know a ton of CISOs that are really, really concerned about their supply chains, the vendors that they rely on. I was actually talking to a healthcare CISO a couple days ago. He had three of his tiny vendors ransomwared in the last week. So they weren't available to him. And then the month before that, he had one of them compromised and send him an invoice for $10 million that was a real invoice, but obviously was not from who it said it was from. Those are the sorts of things that make everybody less safe. And obviously there's lots of different parties that are at fault for that. But ultimately, when it comes to what looks brighter in the future, it's exactly what we talked about. It's prevention, it's services that a smaller organization can actually consume, and it's a greater focus on the outcome as opposed to some of this tech that, while amazing, is really only going to benefit a tiny sliver of the world's organizations.
So specifically, I mean, you mentioned DLP and acquiring a services company that can deliver that better. I mean, what's next? I mean, are you going to be looking at things like cloud config management for SMEs, things like that, like something that can take a look, keep an eye on authorized applications in your environment or provide some controls around that? Like, you know, I'm guessing you're not pushing out to play the EDR game, obviously. So I'm just wondering where, because, you know, Proofpoint, big email company, but like boring, come on, what's next?
Email, though, once you get into the details, is never boring. You're going to make Sherrod very mad if you say that. But the next act for us, if you think about the SME space, the managed services that we're already offering, obviously the email side of things, things like security awareness training, things like DLP, things that we've focused on for a while. The cloud part of that is interesting because some of that actually can be automated really successfully. So looking for risky OAuth applications, putting people through credential set reset workflows, it kind of creeps into what used to be MSSP territory. But ultimately, it's becoming a part of a lot of these products that are effectively powered by cloud APIs. So now that we're trying to take the most comprehensive possible view of what people are doing, how they're being attacked, how they're using data, a lot of this either goes into what used to be called the SOAR bucket, security orchestration, automation, and response, or a services offering that effectively does many of the same things. And that's how we're trying to scale down.
The funny thing is, if you can crack the SMB technology problem, you're kind of solving a lot for big enterprise as well, right? Like I think that's something that people miss, which is if you can provide really good prevention that works for an SMB, if you apply that to an enterprise, man, you make half of the expensive shiny toys that they've just bought not redundant, but a lot less useful, a lot less critical, right?
Oh, like, no, totally. No, totally. And again, I know it's boring, but a lot of that is basically email. My favorite thing that we have done over the last month or so is we rolled out to a bank in Nigeria. And we did this with kind of the core services, you know, email stuff, cloud stuff, security awareness training. And their EDR went from 40,000 alerts a day down to 5 one day and then 0 the next. If you move left in that classic kind of kill chain mindset, it really, really can work. And to your point, that prevention orientation for a bank that had a security team of 3, it's a huge bank, but security team of 3, what are those people going to be able to prioritize all day long?
Well, this is the thing, like prevention is often these days, and people have forgotten this, It's often actually a lighter lift than doing all the response work to, you know, the umpteenth malware infection in your environment that day.
It's extremely expensive to do that work because it's a resource that's not readily available. And I think that's the other thing that I think is something we're factoring into our longer term strategic planning. It's not just about the security qualified personnel shortage at the 1%, which absolutely does exist. You know, retention is a huge problem across the industry. And even just getting qualified personnel at any of those roles is a challenge. And I don't know of a single organization that feels like they have that figured out. But the other shortage that we don't talk about is the people that will never exist. There will never be a security engineer at that 1,000-person company. There will never be that person to go do that work. And that's something that we on the vendor side of the fence need to do a better job building towards. And it's not like it's impossible, to your point, and it really does have results.
Well, and I think it can be profitable these days if you've got the right MSPs working with you. You know, like I sort of feel like it's the economics might actually function in 2022 in a way that they haven't done previously. Ryan Callumber, thank you so much for joining us on the show to chat about all of that. It's good to bring that topic up occasionally because I think we forget that there's this entire category of business, which is most of them, that we just ignore, you know, guilty of it. We're all guilty of it. But thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, Matt.
That was Ryan Callumber of Proofpoint there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to him for that. And of course, you can find Proofpoint at proofpoint.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.